John Chillag, Wheel 4.
And I can not remember his actual comment, but it sort of implied something that, listen to a radio, it won't be long now for you. When I left there and walked down the two flights of stairs, and there was a shot upstairs, and I found out that he shot himself there and then. And this is probably the most vivid memory of the Rana days in and out of the ghetto.
How were you normally regarded? I have read that you delivered message to the SS as well.
Yes.
Yes, how would they have treated you?
The SS treated me what they would call correctly. I wasn't mistreated or abused or anything like that. I was treated as a piece of dirt or scum, but not maltreated or anything like that. I had an official function for them. But all this only was an illusion, because it only lasted for a few days, or a couple of weeks. And after that, people in the ghetto, me included, were driven out with a bit of encouragement from rifle butts and staves and whatever by SS and gendarmerie into the ghetto square, where quite brutally we were all strip searched, including internally. Most of the luggage taken away, and then marched off to the other end of town, where they established what I can call the regional or province ghetto, where not only the town people but all the Jews from the surrounding district were also included. And the conditions in that ghetto were far, far worse than our sort of cramped situation, but otherwise bearable situation in the first one.
Were there still the 35 of you together?
Yes, the full family was still together. And this sort of regional ghetto, were barracks that were built during the First World War to house Italian internee soldiers. Then, obviously, at the end of the war, was disbanded and fell into disuse. Then in the early 30s, gypsies took it over. And they abandoned it because it was so bad. Anything from leaking roofs, which was the minor problem, but no sanitation, no water, no electricity, overrun by vermin. And they just allocated a room in one of those barracks. And no longer was it just 10 or 12 people in the room, but all 30 of us were in that area. We weren't officially confined to the room, but we didn't really go out often. There were latrines that probably would have been sufficient for our family to take all 5,000 people in the encampment. If you were near an SS officer, you probably got either sideswiped by hand or with rifle butt or whatever. So you were keeping out of the way anyway. Some people, they were singling out either knowing who they were looking for or not. Some people, like a local rabbi, they dragged out and they shaved half his head and half his beard and tattooed the Star of David on his head. Others, they were just beating, trying to get valuables out of them. And some were, I say, left alone, weren't actually maltreated. I can't remember, but I don't think anybody from the family was, in the, call it the special category, if you like.
How did you manage for food at that time?
At that time, it was only communal food that was provided, such as it was. I think they brought in, there were no facilities to bake bread or cook or anything like that. They brought in some bread and some canisters of soup or whatever. I can't quite remember, but that sort of provision or non-provision, if you like.
Would you have slept at night?
Sleeping would have been with great difficulty. Try to imagine yourself in a decent sized room of 15 by 15 feet and try to put in there 30 odd people. I don't think there would be enough room to lie down apart from any other problem. So we probably done it in shifts or some sort of half sitting, half lying down.
Would you have been prepared for this, before going into the ghetto in the first place? Did your mother sort out particular clothing, or you were saying you were strip searched, so
yeah.
I imagine it was difficult to hide things, but I wonder what possessions your family had.
To move into the ghetto, we could only take in with us whatever we could carry. My mother, my father, myself. I can't remember what we were carrying, but couldn't carry more than two suitcases each, whatever those suitcases contained. And I suppose that when my parents in particular knew that we were going into this ghetto, and they were doing a bit of selection as to what to put in those suitcases. But that were earthly goods that we took with us. And when we had the strip search and all that, in the ghetto square, some of those things, because the Germans and the gendarme thought it is more valuable to them than it is for us, reduced the quantity of that. I mean, if we had a blanket in there, they probably said, oh, that will go to the front to the soldiers or something like that. But it did or not is another story. So we moved into the second ghetto even lighter, and then we moved into the first one. And ever since the days before we moved into the first ghetto, the Germans were sort of coding us on that eventually you will be moved to the east, where you will work for the war effort, and your families will be housed around you. So when events moved on, we took what they were saying at face value, such as it was.
Had you by this time, now talking, aren't we, of June 1944.
Yes.
Had you heard of what had happened in the East to the Jewish people?
There was absolutely no news coming from the East. What happened to people who were transported to there from many parts of Europe, because there were German Jews who were transported or been told that they were being transported to the East from Czechoslovakia, from Belgium, from Holland, from France, and from many of the overrun countries. Well, in some respects, well, we knew, or certainly we were hoping, that invasion has not taken place. We are in the end game of the war. It can't take very long. It took too long for us. We knew that it can be a very long period. And then from this second ghetto, half the people from there were rounded up and marched one Sunday morning on the 11th of June to the local railway marshalling yards. And when we got there, there was a cattle wagon train of about 40, 50 wagons there. And a little bit of encouragement, rifle butts and staves and what, we were driven into the wagons. About 80 people to the wagon. During the war, some of these wagons had sort of signs on them for 8 horses or 26 men. There were 80 of us in the wagon. People of all ages, from infant to centenarians. And when we were pushed in, there were a couple of buckets put in as well, one with water and one for sanitation, both woefully inadequate. The doors were locked and there was just a small opening covered with barbed wire on the near the top. And that was all the air that was in that wagon for us.
Would you have been in with your family?
There certainly would have been members of the family in our wagon, and there would have been some more probably in the next wagon or wagons up the train. There was no way of you come behind my sign, this is the Chilak family. Probably 10 of us from the family were in that wagon.
You would have been with your parents, would you?
I think so, yes. Mm. Yeah, I would be, yes.
Mm. I was wondering, you know, you were still a very young boy, weren't
yes,
you?
Yes, I was just 17.
Yes. Did your parents talk to you about what was going on, give you advice, or, you know, as a youngster facing these things? Can you remember?
I can't really remember. I mean, the first time something really seriously has gone wrong was in towards the tail end of the second ghetto days. Everybody was babbling in a very confined space. I can't remember, but I don't think much could have been said. And after all, we were going to a workplace in the East, which I certainly took as gospel. And I would presume so did my parents. And more most other people on, all other people on the train.
Had you heard the name Wallenberg at this time?
No. The all the provinces were treated in much the same way as we were in Dürr. And there were altogether some 130 odd trains of Jews who were deported, with I believe only three or four trains from the Budapest area to what turned out to be Auschwitz. The rest of the Hungarian Jews in Budapest were left for the time being in Budapest. And perhaps I ought to come back a little bit later because this will be another story rather than the one I'm concentrating at the moment.
Come back to Wallenberg.
Wallenberg and that situation.
Yes, so here you are on the cattle, 80 of you, crammed in cattle trucks.
And here I must tell an interesting story, because what happened when these deportation trains, and there were throughout the country some 130 of these, each taking something like 3,000 people. When these trains were organized by the Germans, they decided that a few trains from the most western part of Hungary should go to the factories in Austria and the rest of it to the east. But the SS escorts were so used that all trains were going to the east that they were virtually across the Carpathians before they discovered that this train should have gone to Austria. And there were some, what I found out later, some hurried phone conversations between them and the command. And they said, well, you got this far. Proceed as you are used to. And we will send another train to Austria. And the irony of the situation was that most of the people who went to Austria had survived without too much problem. Yes, they had a problem. Nothing of the scale or nothing of the type that was awaiting for us. And in all this train journey, apart from the obvious misery in the wagons, I can remember two things. One, or only two things. One, that it was mid-June, and during the day, even without a crowded situation, it would have been extremely hot. And as we were getting to the Carpathians, at night, it was freezing, even with all the people in there. And the other thing is something quite curious, and I don't know how the human mind works. I remember that looking out through that little slit in the window, I remember it's the one of the most beautiful scenes, and mountains and all that we went through. But apart from that, there wasn't that much to remember of the trip. But these are the only sort of memories that stick out. Anyway, the next day, I presume, must have been 15th or 16th of June, we arrived at a railway siding. We didn't know where we were, other than obviously, we knew we were going across the Carpathians. I think I may remember some sign that the train was going through Krakow. We arrived in what turned out to be Auschwitz, a place nobody ever heard of before, or certainly none of us. We were driven out from the train. It took a lot of driving out because a number of people had died on the journey. A number of people were very sick as a result of it. People, anything from infants to old people in there. And we're lined up on the siding, and there was half a dozen SS officers in front. And they were sort of directing us, you go in that group and you go in the other one. And all the family who was there with us in the wagon or in the next couple of wagons with us, were directed in one direction, with only my father and one of my uncles. That was the uncle who was put into Schutzhaft immediately after the occupation by the Germans. They're put in the other group, obviously with a fair number of people, but the other group with mainly women, older people, children, was a much larger group. And we are still in earshot, though we were told that that group is going to a family accommodation. And you go to the workplace and meet up in the evening or morning or whatever. And we still accepted that at face value. I mean, the SS escort and by that time the capos from the camp, they were pretty brutal getting around their business, but, other than that, we were still accepting what was there. And our group was marched into the camp. Incidentally, not Auschwitz, but Birkenau, which is the main camp. Auschwitz was mainly the administrative bit. There was a sort of a main road dividing that particular camp in half. And we were marched in there. One half of the camp was taken up entirely by gypsies, because Jews weren't the only people persecuted by the Nazis. Anything from gypsies, politicals, criminals, homosexuals, Jehovah's Witnesses, and God only knows what other group. We were also persecuted. And we were marched into the other half of the camp, which, again, it wasn't officially subdivided, but the majority of the people there were Czech families who had been there for quite some time. And the other half of that particular part of the camp for Hungarian Jews. And when they started deporting the Hungarian Jews, they started from the east. So the closest to Auschwitz people were taken first, and we furthest away were virtually the tail end, not quite, but virtually the tail end of the trains. And each of these barracks, which were occupied by us, were occupied by about 1,000 people, woefully inadequate for the number of people. There were bunks or levels inside, and 3 or 4 levels of bunks. And even so, a lot of the people only had room in the corridors between the bunks, and two or three people who had to sort of squeeze into a bunk. So it was very inadequate.
Where did you squeeze? Where did you?
Well, I was there for a while, so there were days when I could lie down, there were days when I was sitting in the corridor, there were days when I was sitting on a bunk. But one made the best what one could. And we were the, what shall I say, the elite, and the strongest, the most active people. So there was a lot of shoving and pushing. It wasn't a peaceful organization as to where you sit, sleep, or what. That we were overnight, and in the morning we were driven out from the barracks because the barracks had to be spotlessly clean during the day. So we were driven out from the barracks, and our breakfast was brought in to the area between the barracks. Some canisters with some liquid described as tea or coffee, but God only knows what it was. At that stage, steaming, because it was hot in the canisters and it was cold in the surrounding outside area. But we had to undergo a roll call. The camp itself was surrounded by double electrified wire with dogs and SS patrolling in between and watchtowers. So there wasn't any way to escape anyway. So the roll call was formality in that way. But our guards bought Polish and German capos and SS guards. They're not mathematics professors, so during a roll call, people lined up higgledy-piggledy in sort of rows of five. They're not easy to count anyway. So very often we were still being counted at 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock midday. And when we were dismissed, when everything added up, then we were let loose on our canisters of coffee by that or tea. By that time, obviously, cold hasn't improved. If it could get worse, I don't know whether it did or not, but that's another story. And then for the rest of the day, except for the handful of people who were selected, who were selected to clean up the barracks, we were left to our own resources. We tried to keep ourselves, what shall I say, intellectually occupied with all sorts of games or playing chess in our head or things like that, or learning or practicing languages or whatever. An open university, really in the open. And then in the afternoon, roll call came about again. Again, when it was finished, we were let into our barrack. And we were given our daily rations. We were given a loaf of bread. At that time, 28 people, one loaf of bread, and one slab of margarine for the same number. That quantity has marginally improved. We're getting about twice as much a bit later. We've been given a mug or whatever, which we had to guard with our life. And that was filled with some sort of cabbage soup or something similar, beet soup or what of nondescript nature and varying density. And then we were allowed to get to our bunks and, in inverted commas, sleep.